Decentraland Podcast with David Amoyama.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcioland podcast. So we have a fun episode planned for you today. On Friday, I mentioned to you, since we didn't do an interview after the winter break, after the winter transfer window, that we're going to make it up to you this week. And we actually have two interviews today. We have our friend Kubani on Hamsik's fairly shocking departure from Napoli. He's heading to China, and a long overdue deep dive on Atalanta with our friend Bruno Bottaro. Really, really outstanding. If you've been curious about what Atalanta is all about, if you want to hear about their key players, I think you'll really enjoy it. He is someone that really knows the club intimately. You're not going to get the same talking points you constantly hear on Atalanta, so I think you'll enjoy it. We'll, of course, have our winners and losers. And because we've had two interviews, we're just going to do one Twitter question on pop culture that's been overdue for a while. But before we get to all that, I am joined by our great friend, the producer, co-host of the program, Alex Goldberg, who is on Cloud Nine. We're both based in Boston. He's a big Pats fan. I'm not. Pats win the Super Bowl once again, but I have to ask you, Alec, on a completely different related note, Juve fans on Twitter are going absolutely crazy following the loss to Atalanta in the Coppa Italia. We had the home draw against Parma, which, by the way, 1,000 names called in his predictions. So I want to ask you, do you think it's overblown to say that Juve is in a crisis, as Juve Twitter is saying right now?
Yes, I absolutely do. I think crisis is really, really strong. I mean, I had trouble using that word. I still used it, but I had trouble using that word last week for Chelsea, once Chelsea got blown out to Bournemouth 4-0. And Chelsea are way more of a circus than Juve are, even with what's going on with Juve and Dybala and the fact that they just drew to Parma at home and all of the above with some of the injuries. It is not a crisis. It is absolutely not a crisis, because Juventus fans, you're 9 points clear in first place in Serie A. You're winning the Scudetto again. You're winning the Scudetto again. So for me, a crisis would have to be you're in jeopardy of not winning another Scudetto. And I understand you are so used to winning the Scudetto now that the standards have changed. The level of expectation has changed. Now it really sometimes does feel like it's Champions League or bust. And if anything else goes wrong, you could say you're in a crisis. But you're not in a crisis. You are 9 points clear in Serie A. And for me, this is the time of year where even the elite teams, even the teams that have it together, that have great managers like Allegri, this is the time of year where maybe there's a rut, maybe there's doubts. There hasn't been Champions League football for a little while, obviously. It's going to get revamped very soon. This is the time where doubt starts to set in. Maybe a player's unsettled, a.k.a. Paulo Dybala. Maybe injuries are piling up. This is pretty normal, in my opinion. I know it feels like the sky is falling to some because, hey, draw 3-3 to Parma, which definitely should not happen at home. But you got to remember, this was the first game in some way, shape, or form that one of the members of the BBC was not playing since 2012 or even called for the match. So that's pretty significant. And yeah, there are injuries, but Bernardeschi is really okay. He doesn't have crack ribs, just a blow to the side. Yeah, the thing with Dybala is not great, but I mean, it just feels like Juventus' success is never dependent on Dybala. He's almost become a luxury for Juventus, which is kind of extreme to say. But David, you said at the top, you mentioned that the New England Patriots won the Super Bowl, and I promise I will not spiel on the Patriots too long. This is a Calcio podcast. But we have paralleled before Juventus to the New England Patriots. I've paralleled Max Allegri to Bill Belichick at times in terms of what great managers, coaches they are, and how great of a grasp they have on their team. All season long, the New England Patriots were doubted. They had losses they never should have had to lesser opponents. And the whole year, oh, are the New England Patriots finally falling off? Are they finally falling off? And guess what happened? Right when it mattered most, and David, you talk about it all the time, Max Allegri sometimes plays his best football when the season is at the end, when the Champions League and Serie A are really ramping up. That's when some of his best football comes out. That was the same with the Patriots, and it always proves to be the same with the Patriots. And you don't become a dominant team like Juve is without being able to get through adversity. It is about mental toughness. It's about getting through adversity. I really think Allegri is just as good as anybody in terms of getting through adversity. I do not think Juve are in a crisis at all. I just know right now, with all of the reports left and right about a Dybala, a draw, Bernardeschi, Douglas Costa, I understand it, but you're not in a crisis. David, that's my take. What about you?
Yeah, I'm with you there. I will say there is the potential for a crisis. And for me, this is really what's going on with the defense. You mentioned, you know, the BBC had a first line they don't play in a while. And, you know, right away when the Benatia deal happened, I really was surprised by it. I'm kind of surprised Juve didn't try to really make it worth his while to stay, you know, until the end of the season, wait 5 months before going to get a huge contract in Qatar. It's really been the worst case scenario, though, with Benatia, because, of course, Bonucci got hurt basically the day the deal's done that Caceres is back. Then Chiellini gets hurt against Atalanta, although it sounds that both of them will be back against Atletico Madrid. And if you're a Juve fan, you better hope and pray that that happens. You know, I've never been a big Rugani fan. I hope, you know, he turns it around for his sake, the Italian national team's sakes and Juve's sake. Sure, he's not helped that he had to play next to Caceres, who's just back at the team. So, no, I don't think it's a crisis, but there is the potential for it. I think Juve's great defense in the past, you know, helped them overlooked, you know, the issues in the midfield. Now, I don't think Juve's midfield is as catastrophic as some people make it out to be, but it's definitely, you know, not like the great midfields that Juve had. So they still have a great offense. They're still fantastic on the wings. Cancelo, Alexandro, you mentioned Bernardeschi, Douglas Costa, of course, Mandzukic is back. So there are, you know, definitely a lot of reasons to be optimistic. And then, you know, look, at the end of the day, you mentioned Juve's at the top of the standings. In 22 matches, they've won 19. They haven't lost any. It happens against Parma. They actually put in a great performance. I think they deserve credit as well. The match against Atalanta, yeah, that was concerning. Took away the treble from the equation, but Atalanta's also red hot. And then, you know, if you want to Juve fans, if you want to see what a real crisis looks like, you should just look at Inter right now. The fact that they brought in Ranocchia as an emergency center forward while they were losing at home against Bologna, who hadn't won an away match in a full calendar year and hadn't won since late September, really sums it all up. You know, it's all relative, but that's what a crisis looks like. So Juve fans, at the end of the day, you know, it's really going to come down to what happens against Atletico Madrid. I think the lead in Serie A is very solid. I think Napoli is going to rightfully focus a lot on the Europa League. So as long as Juve can get to those matches against Atletico Madrid in good shape, I would certainly not describe this as a crisis.
All right, David. Well, let's get to our classic Monday edition of Winners and Losers. We do have two Serie A matches happening today, but we have plenty to talk about from the weekend. So without further ado, who are winners and losers of episode 192 of the Calcioland podcast?
Yeah, so we have to start with Parma. And again, you know, their players get paid too. It's not just about Juve struggling. We had quite a few put in a great performance. Of course, Gervinho with a brace. Bruno Alves, the Portuguese defender, who actually was linked to Juve right after Chiellini got hurt against Atalanta. Parma ended up extending his contract. He put in another great performance. And then another player, very underrated move during the January window, and that's Kuchka, the defensive midfielder who used to play at Milan. He was brilliant in that match against Juve. So kudos to Parma for building off their excellent first season, keeping their core players, bringing in another veteran to boost their team, and it really paid off against Juve. Now, it's not all doom and gloom for Juve. Ronaldo had a brace. Not surprising, he looks much better once Mandzukic is there next to him. Now, Mandzukic also at the end was one of the people responsible for Parma scoring the game-tying goal, but Mandzukic was a factor also in Ronaldo. Definitely, he's the type of player that makes everyone better around him. And then we have to give a shout-out to Khedira. I know some Juve fans are really reticent to do that. I thought he played pretty well against Parma. So let's see if he can sustain this. Juve could certainly use that. And then we had Napoli's very impressive win against Sampdoria. Insigne back on the scoring sheet. Milik continues to score at a high rate. They were able to make sure that Quagliarella didn't score to surpass Batistuta goal scoring streak. Koulibaly had an absolutely brilliant play. Defensively, Koulibaly continues to receive huge ovations every time he plays at the San Paolo. I know some people thought that with the racist incidents, he might be more likely to leave. You have to hand it to Napoli and their fans. They might have turned what was a potential negative into a complete positive. I think the way they've embraced him after those incidents, if anything, takes that racist aspect off the table, but might actually make him more likely to stay because of the affection he received there. We talked about Inter's crisis, but also shout out to Bologna. Sinisa Mihailovic's first match at the club must have felt really good for him to win at San Siro, where he used to coach Milan. While most Inter players looked really demotivated and put in, you know, a lot of work, Palacio put in incredible work rate in that match. Santander scored the game winner, so kudos to Bologna there. Then we had the outstanding match between Milan and Roma. More VAR drama. Now, the reports that the VAR machine doesn't work at all at the Olimpico, and that's why they didn't go to the review, which would be pretty incredible. But let's give some shout-outs on the pitch. De Rossi came back from his injury. They really needed him to show his leadership and his experience after the debacle against Fiorentina, and he certainly did. Zaniolo put in another great performance for Roma. There's really nothing this kid can't do right now. I don't want to jinx him, but he really, really looks incredible. On the Milan side, Donnarumma had another spectacular match. Donnarumma, other than the derby against Inter, has been sensational this season. I don't want to be a prisoner at the moment, but, you know, it wouldn't be outrageous to think that both Donnarumma and Zaniolo can get to 100 caps on the Azzurri because of their young age and amazing talent. Also on Milan, Piontek scored. Paqueta had the assist. Two really impactful additions from the January window. And then we've had another very good performance from Romagnoli. Milan's defense been really, really good recently. Look, on Twitter, you'll read all about the tactical limitations that Gattuso has. And I think there is something to it, but he's really solidified that defense. And Romagnoli's been playing very well since coming back from the injury. Speaking of Piontek, the striker that replaced him on Genoa, Sanabria, scored again. He's had two goals in a row for them. Genoa needs him to do well. Granted, they have also Kwame, who had another strong performance, but they need someone who's going to help with the scoring load. So those are our winners. Let's flip to the losers. Rugani, hate to pick on him, but not a good performance once again. Caceres, too, just arrived. Juve's defense definitely looks shaky. And Mandzukic, like on the last goal for Parma. I remember when I was a kid playing in Italy, one of the things our coaches used to always tell us, if you're on defense, never pass it towards the middle of the pitch if we're close to our penalty box. And Mandzukic broke that rule. Speaking of another center back that's been a young center back that's been receiving a lot of hype, the defender on Sampdoria, Anderson, who was sensational the first half of the season, he's been struggling recently. Muriel schooled him when Fiorentina played against Sampdoria. He had another difficult performance against Napoli. On Roma, we mentioned Zaniolo and De Rossi as winners. Kolarov and Fazio, on the other hand, continue to be big liabilities. I think Roma made a big mistake not adding at least one somewhat starting caliber defender to the team, especially a center back. Karsdorf's been a nice addition on the right, but Kolarov looks like he's running out of gas on the left. And on Inter, really bad performance against Bologna. Icardi missed the sitter that Pioli absolutely gifted him. Lautaro Martinez has been struggling recently. Spalletti, now with all the drama, and today Marotta said that he's safe through the match against Parma, the dreaded vote of confidence, but he looks like he's losing the team. You know, it wasn't just Perisic. There were reports of other players wanting to leave in January. We knew about Miranda. It sounds like potentially also Gagliardini, Vecina were all looking to get out. So Spalletti looks in trouble. You know, Conte, you know, there's the shadow looming over him. Conte keeps saying he'll only take a team at once the new season starts. But you have to wonder if Conte sees maybe I need to get in there to guarantee we get to the Champions League for next season. So Spalletti is on the hot seat. One thing that does help him is last year he signed an extension. He has a contract through 2021. He's one of the highest paid coaches in Serie A. Getting rid of him would cost Inter close to 20 million. So you have to wonder if that's going to buy him more time. And speaking of Inter, other losers are the Ultras and the Curva Nord. They issued a statement denouncing the club's anti-racist campaign, taking some shots at Koulibaly. A really, really poor statement. You know, I'm a big believer in karma and the energy that you put out. And Inter, quite frankly, hasn't been the same since the Koulibaly incident at San Siro. That really brought a dark shadow on the team. And a last one, we a couple more towards the bottom of the table. We had Torino there. They had a draw against Spal. If they want to contend for a Europa League spot, those are exactly the types of matches they need to start winning. And that was a very uninspiring match against Spal. Another match for the race to avoid relegation. Empoli really needed to beat Chievo at home. That was the early game Saturday. The match ended up being 2-2. Bad result for both teams, because if Chievo wants to have any chance, and it's an extreme long shot of getting out of the race to avoid relegation, they had to win that match. To their credit, they played really hard. But Empoli, those were 2 points they left on the table that they might come back to regret. And last one, we had Fiorentina travel to Friuli to play against Udinese. I was surprised by how many boos Muriel received there. We had another uninspiring match by Piacca. So those are our winners and losers for the week. Now, next up, we have an interview, and this one came out of the blue because of Hamsik. All the reports are that the match against Sampdoria was his last one for Napoli. So De Laurentiis today during the press conference to announce where Napoli is going to do their summer retreats didn't really deny it. He said, at the proper time, I'll explain what happened. So we want to bring in our friend Marco D'Onofrio Cubani to pay tribute to Hamsik and also get his reasoning on why he thinks this move happened. And he gave some really insightful answers. Okay, so next up is our great friend Marco D'Onofrio. You guys know him as Cubani on Twitter. He covers Serie A on Stadio Serie A, although right now they are on a short hiatus as they start over a new phase, which I'm really curious to see. You can also hear him on the Far From Vesuvius podcast, where he covers Napoli. He also writes for Football Italia and Soccer 360 Mag. So, Marco, it's always great to have you on, but I have to say this has been a weird week for you because you're based in Toronto. Giovinco leaves. Yeah. Out of the blue, and we'll record on Sunday. Out of the blue, the news comes that this is Hamsik's last game at for Napoli. And you know, there was speculation, but that we saw Paolo Cannavaro get the last jersey, so it seems all but done. So, welcome back to Calcioland. But how are you holding up, buddy? This is a lot of departures in a short amount of time.
Oh, David, I'm laughing because I'm trying not to cry, man, especially after you mentioned Giovinco too. It really has been just a weird week and a weird week to say goodbye to to two legends at their clubs. And it's strange because, in all honesty, I didn't expect either to happen. Not this year, anyways. I mean, maybe in the summertime for Hamsik and maybe after the season for Giovinco. But hey, listen, sometimes opportunities come up that you just can't turn down. And I think they're in very, very different circumstances, though. And I'll say that with Giovinco and Hamsik.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good point. And, you know, they are getting, you know, substantial paydays. But, yeah, I agree with you. They definitely feel quite different. But let's go to yesterday. So Napoli, Quagliarella comes, hometown boy, with a goal streak on the line that he didn't keep going. Napoli puts in a really good performance. You know, they didn't look that great against Milan. And then out of the blue, I was watching the game, and complete surprise to me, I saw Di Marzio tweeting this was going to be Hamsik's last game. So let me ask you, you already mentioned that you were surprised, but what about the timing? You know, also right after the January window closes, did this completely blindside you?
I was shocked. in all honesty, I was shocked. And then when I saw the DiMaggio tweet, that's when I knew it was real, right? Because, I mean, you heard all kinds of rumors running rampant, and, you know, you knew that there was something there and that he was probably going to leave to China. If it wasn't, you know, he had the opportunity this past summer, but you really thought he would stick it out this year and leave the coming up summer. And to see it happen after the Sampdoria game the way it did was just shocking. And, you know, he did receive a standing ovation when he was taken off the pitch, but I think it speaks volumes about his character that he didn't want to make it all about himself, because he could have announced earlier before the game that this would be my last game and the São Paulo probably would have been sold out. But he didn't want that attention. He didn't want to make it about himself, especially on a day where another hometown hero, Fabio Quagliarella, could have made history. And in all honesty, I was really rooting to see him score a goal and break Batistuta's record, which was unfortunately not the case. But yeah, it does seem weird. The timing of it all seems strange. But at the same time, I think the club probably knew this was coming, and they had probably been known or aware of it for a while. So, as a fan, the timing is weird of it all. But listen, Merrick owes the club nothing. And to see him go, as long as he's happy and it's the decision that he really wants to make, then all the power to him.
Yeah, I mean, financially, you can't really complain, although, you know, he was one of the highest paid players on Napoli, if not the highest, you know, relatively speaking, he left a lot of money on the table. So let me ask you, you know, he is leaving now when his prime has ended. I would say this season and last season, you could definitely see the decline coming. So does the fact that, you know, on one hand, he is leaving in the middle of the season after the January window closes, so you can't really replace him, but does the fact that, you know, he's leaving, he gave Napoli his prime, and it's not like he's going to a European team, more importantly, he's not going to Juve, does that kind of soften the blow for you?
Absolutely. I mean, listen, Hamsik gave Napoli everything and, you know, the best years of his career. And he had multiple opportunities to leave the club and, you know, to a Juventus or a Milan, and he never did. Right. So, I think that does speak volumes again about who he is as a person and the character that he has, because we also know that he ended up parting ways with Mino Raiola, who was at one point trying to convince him to leave Napoli. And he said, you know what, I'd rather have a new agent than have you. And I think that speaks volumes again about who he is. So, yeah, you know what, the timing is odd again, but at the same time, listen, it makes sense because he is older. He's looking for one last payday to set up not only himself, but his family and his family tree for decades to come. So you can't blame him for that. So you know what? Again, he's going to China. He's going to a team that probably most of us have never even heard of. And so if it's a decision that makes sense for him and his family, then I think every Napoli supporter has to appreciate what he's done. And you know what? I just wish he got the proper send-off that he deserved. Mm-hmm. Really, I think that's all that was missing from yesterday's game.
Yeah, I agree with you there. So we're going to close it on, you know, your favorite memories on him. But I want to ask you, you know, how this impacts Napoli both in the short term and the long term. So to me, him leaving the way he did really speaks volumes of his career. He's always been understated and whatnot. But it was, you know, in retrospect, now it looks a little bit odd that they let Marco Rog, who, you know, played a little bit more under Ancelotti, but maybe not as much as he would have wanted, they let him go on loan. And then a few days later, Hamsik leaves, the window closes. Do you feel Napoli's midfield's a little short, or are you pretty comfortable? I mean, they do. I will say they have a lot of quality options, but maybe they're a player short. What's your feeling on this?
Yeah, you're right, because in hindsight, it looks a little bit odd to let Rog. I mean, to be honest, he's been a disappointment since he's come to Napoli, and he hasn't gotten the playing time that he probably needs to thrive, so I hope him going on loan will help with that. But it does seem a little bit odd now that Hamsik's gone, Rog is gone, because you're right, you have quality, and you have players that can replace Hamsik, and the Zielinskis, the Diawaras, you know, you have Alain still, so you've got some, and Fabian Ruiz has been incredible this year, so you've got the quality in the midfield, but now you lack the depth. And so you're right. That's a real question mark going forward. I wonder if Napoli had progressed in the Coppa Italia, would Hamsik have left? Because maybe that's what he was holding on for, to try to win one more major trophy. And you know what? The Europa League is still very possible for this club to try to go and achieve. But you know, yeah, they do look a little bit thin in the midfield, and we'll see what happens going forward. But at the same time, again, listen, Hamzik stuck it out this season. He tried to play in a new role under Ancelotti, and you know what? He had a hell of a game yesterday. He did really, really look good against Sampdoria. So it is what it is, but at the same time, you know what? As thin as Napoli look in the midfield, they do have some quality. It's just unfortunate that, you know, they can't get another depth player into the squad right now, but we'll see what happens in the long run. I think they'll be okay this season, but they're definitely going to need to add some tools going forward, especially in the summertime.
Yeah. So speaking of that, like, in my opinion, and I was thinking more of this when there were the rumors that Alan could leave to PSG, mm-hmm. and I don't know how close that ever got. There's some people, you know, in Napoli that thought it was really close. And in my mind, I was like, you know, on the bright side, Napoli is just so great at finding midfielders that, as great as Alan's been, you know, to me, it'd be much harder to replace someone, let's say, like Koulibaly, which is fairly obvious. So let me get your perspective. You know, now I guess this applies more to Hamsik. Jorginho left. You mentioned Fabian Ruiz. Is it at least, do you have supreme confidence in Napoli's ability to find great young midfielders? Because they've certainly been able to do that in recent years.
Yeah, they always have been able to. And I mean, you know, you look at even losing Jorginho in the summer, and it feels like they haven't missed a beat. With that said, you can never guarantee a quality, young, talented midfielder, especially someone of the quality of Hamzik coming in and doing what he did for the club. So it's never easy to replace someone like Hamzik, especially everything he meant to the team. But listen, with Ancelotti at the helm, I think this team will be okay. And I think they'll be fine. And I'm glad you brought up Alan, because maybe that's also what Hamzik was waiting for, was that had Alan left, maybe he would have stuck it out, right?
Yeah.
I don't think Hamzik left Napoli in a situation that he knew they wouldn't be able to handle. And I think that maybe the timing of this whole situation. I mean, you look at, say, like a Bonatti and what he ended up doing to Juve, which to me, I'm not even a Juventino, but I would be furious with the guy. Because I think he left them in a really difficult situation, where Hamzik, I think, is leaving Napoli in a place where he knows they'll be able to at least survive the rest of the season. And I think that's important. So we'll see what happens in the future, because, you know, we can never really know. But I think Ancelotti at the helm, they'll be able to bring in somebody, you know, in the summertime to kind of help deal with the depth issue going on right now. But midfield has always been one of Napoli's strengths. Whether it was under Sarri, Benitez, now Ancelotti. So I think overall they'd be okay. It's just, you're right though. Right now they do look a little bit thin, but I'm sure Ancelotti and the likes can bring in somebody in the summer to kind of help deal with that.
So let's close on this, and I really appreciate you joining me on short notice to discuss this. So, you know, Hamsik, the last game was excellent. He leaves Napoli after scoring the most goals. Club's history, surpassed Maradona this season. He surpassed Bruscolotti. So both Maradona and Bruscolotti, key players when they won the titles for most games played. Out of all the time he spent at Napoli, what is your favorite memory, or even one or two things that really stand out to you when you look back on Hamsik's time at Napoli?
Yeah, it's crazy because there really are so many. You know, and he was around during the three tenor days with Lovetzi and Cavani. For me, one of them definitely has to be when he sealed that Coppa Italia win against Juve in 2012 with that second goal, and seeing him, you know, and seeing that team lift that first trophy in the De Laurentiis era will always, you know, have a special place in my heart. And then the other one's a personal memory of, I was actually at the São Paulo when he tied Maradona's record, which was really, really cool thing. And he actually had the opportunity to break it that same day. It was against Cagliari, and they had a penalty shot. I believe it was 2-0 at the time. And everybody was, you know, Merrick's got to take it. And he didn't want to take it, because I don't think he wanted to break the record that way. And again, that just speaks volumes of who he is. And, you know, he had a long drought actually following that before he finally did break it. But again, I just, there's so much. And again, even earlier when I mentioned the Raiola story and how, you know, Raiola was trying to convince him to leave, and Raiola ended up being fired as his agent. I mean, there's all those little moments. Or when he went to talk to the ultras during the Coppa Italia final, with the chaos that was going on when it was Napoli Fiorentina in 2014. There's just so many little moments that both on and off the pitch that he really was a symbol of the club and a symbol of loyalty. And I think a lot of Napoli fans woke up this morning with a little piece missing in their hearts. But, you know, again, we just have to be grateful for everything he's done for the club. And I just wish that he had left, again, with a proper send-off or getting to lift a trophy one last time for the club. But as long as he's happy and everything is okay with him and his family, and this is the decision he really wants to make, then all the power to him. And as Napoli fans, we just got to sit back and say thank you, because he may have been one of the greatest captains, if not the greatest captain that the club had ever had.
Very well said. So, Marco, thank you so much for joining me. You guys can hear Marco on the Far From Vesuvius podcast. You can read him on Football Italia, Soccer 360 Mag. And like many others, I'm really looking forward to seeing what you have planned over at Stadio Serie A when you guys come back. So, Marco, thank you so much for coming on. As always, you're a great guest, and I really appreciate you hopping on to Calcioland.
Nah, David, the pleasure is all mine, buddy. And anytime you come to reach out, I'm always happy to do it. So thank you, and you keep up the good work, because nobody works harder than you do in this industry. So hats off to you, buddy, and thank you so much.
So, David, before we get to our next interview, we just want to say we're not doing our normal segment with Twitter questions today, because we do have two interviews. So we will get to Twitter questions on Thursday's episode. But we do want to address one Twitter question. It's not related to football, but this person has been sending in these questions for a while. So we want to answer this. David, what are some of the best opening scenes in movies?
Yeah, so a while back, if you remember, we were asked to name the best final scenes in movies, and I gave some answers. We got some great tweets from our listeners. So this question came in on some of the best opening scenes in a movie. So I wanted to take the weekend to think about it. So I'm going to kind of break them down in two categories. For me, when I think of a great opening scene, there's two types. There's one, you know, that sets the tone for the movie, that really fits in to what the narrative of the film is. It's pretty natural. And then there's another opening scene where it's really more, not really related to the plot of the movie. It's really more to kind of frame the movie, you know, something really exciting that, you know, it could be a backstory, something that happened in the past, but something that really doesn't fit the plot. So I'm going to start with those. And I think the best answer, and I think it's hard to top this opening scene, regardless of if it's a plot driven or just on its own, is the first scene in Saving Private Ryan. I mean, that one's just unbelievable. I think that's Steven Spielberg apex, just really, really unsettling. That's the D-Day, you know, military scene in Saving Private Ryan. Truly incredible. Another one that I really enjoyed is Space Odyssey, Kubrick, the movies from the 60s. And this is the opening scene where it's all when man kind of was spurred from the apes, when you see apes fighting and when the ape starts holding the bone, and you can kind of start seeing the evolution. That's an unbelievable scene. I could almost watch a whole movie based on that. Then another one, I'm not a big into the fantasy genre, but I really enjoyed the opening scene of Two Towers and The Lord of the Rings with Smeagol with the ring, how he finds the ring and all that. That's a one that I really, really enjoy. Then one that is kind of about the plot of the movie, but is almost a standalone scene, is the opening scene in Inglourious Bastards. Fantastic scene there with the Jews hiding under the farm in the house. Just really fantastic. That's like a Hitchcock level scene. So those I would say are kind of scenes that kind of stand alone on their own and that could be their own movie. I'm going to transition to those that are more the classic style. I'm going to start with Jaws, the opening scene in Jaws from the 70s. You know, that's when you don't see the shark. You just see the first victim of the shark. You have the iconic music of Jaws, just a really amazing scene, holds up incredibly well. Kind of also shocking that there was nudity in it back then. That was a movie rated PG. And in the 70s, I guess everything went with that. So on the more classic, though, opening scenes, some that stood out to me, we mentioned Inglourious Basterds, Tarantino. Another one that I really love is Reservoir Dogs, just because of the dialogue. This is the one when they're all in the diner talking about Madonna songs. I have to say, that's one of the things that maybe decided that I wanted to get into writing because it was so inspiring to me. Then another one that I really enjoyed is the opening scene in There Will Be Blood. You have Johnny Greenwood's soundtrack, Daniel Day-Lewis with the oil, just a fantastic opening scene. The opening scene in Trainspotting, the original one, fantastic, which is the one of the, with the monologue on Choose Life, which is fantastic, which was then also shown a little bit in the sequel. And then the last two that I want to mention is the opening scene in Dark Knight, the bank robbery, which is outstanding. And I hadn't picked up on this till I heard something on the Rewatchables podcast on The Ringer, how so much of that scene is a tribute to Heat, the Michael Mann movie with De Niro and Pacino. If you rewatch that scene, if you watch the bank robbery scene in Heat, you'll see a lot of parallels. And the last one that I want to mention is the opening scene in Children of Men. The director Cuarón is almost certainly going to win the Oscar for Best Director in Roma. The opening scene in Children of Men, you know, which is a kind of in the futuristic post-apocalyptic world, that scene is mind-blowing. If you haven't seen that movie, it's an amazing movie. If you've seen that movie but you haven't, you know, thought about it in a while, definitely check out that first scene.
All right, great stuff there. And as we said, we will do way more Twitter questions on Thursday in that episode. So per usual, send in your questions for David using the CulturaLand hashtag. All right, David, let's get to our second interview this episode, an interview focusing on Atalanta with our friend Bruno Bataro.
Okay, so for the second interview of today's podcast, we've been wanting to circle back on Atalanta, who have been absolutely red hot and maybe the best story in all of Serie A, along with Milan's resurgence recently. So some of you might remember a while back, we had Bruno Bataro on, and he gave us more of like a history of Atalanta, a lot of the things going on. Off the pitch. But we wanted to bring him back because, again, he was a great guest. And we want to talk more specifically about what's going on with Atalanta. And Bruno now is based in Germany. Last time we had him on, he was in Turkey. He now works for DAZN, the Italian version of the station, doing great work there. So, Bruno, bentornato to CulturaLand. It's a real pleasure to have you on.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay. So, Bruno, I have to say, Atalanta got off to a fairly slow start to the season. They were eliminated in the Europa League. They had started their preparation early for that. The results were really poor at one point. Not that I thought Gasperini was on the hot seat, but on some other teams, you know, some with a streak like that, he might have been. So let me ask you, how surprised have you been by the turnaround for Atalanta after that slow start?
Well, actually, I'm not surprised at all now. As I told you in the last time we talked back in August, I was more probably surprised and negatively impressed by how the team didn't manage to eliminate Copenhagen in that Europa League qualifier we were about to talk about. And that was a huge blow, to be honest, to the team, to the expectations. However, Gasperini's teams always need a little bit of time to improve, to gain the best form. And it had happened also in the first year he was in Bergamo. He started out quite badly, almost going into the relegation fight, and then everything changed. So basically, this has happened again this season, but the team is even better, even with a lot of players being sold out in the last seasons, but that doesn't matter. I think that's one of the best Atalanta I've ever seen.
Yeah, which leads me to my next question. I mean, I've been following Atalanta for a long time. The last time you were on, you know, you described them as the queen of the Provinciali in Italy. And I think that's a very well-deserved title. So where does this rank among the Atalantas that you've seen? Can you make a case for this being the best one, potentially?
I will be, well, absolutely, yes. Of course, I'm young, but from my age, I can see this is, of course, the best Atalanta I have seen. And in the three Gasperini years, the team's constantly improved. They're playing an innovative, fresh kind of football we all watch. And the three-man defense line, for example, is a real three-man defense line. And that's an important tactical point because that's not so tactically common in Italy. We see three-man defense lines, but they are five-man defense lines, in truth. Many defensive systems are more speculative than anything else. Atalanta is a different matter. The same way Gasperini's Genoa, I can say it was. And now we're seeing the best of it. During the 3-0 against Juventus, the team looked so comfortable, as if they were like exactly in their elements, I can say. So I am looking forward, to be honest, to the rest of the season. Because with this Atalanta, well, the best is always yet to come.
Well said. So good transition. I like the observation that this isn't, you know, a fake five-man defense that, you know, you make it sound better by saying it's three. So I want to ask you, the wingbacks on Atalanta, you know, in the past, you know, we had Conti, we had Spinazzola, we've had some really good ones. But the new group, and now it's kind of three of them, we have Castagne, Gosens, and Hodebor. Would you say these three are more important to the team than the two kind of defensive midfielders? Because I think Froehler and Duran are really, really solid. If you had to pick one unit, the three wing backs or the two central midfielders, which of the two have been more important to the team?
I would say the midfield at the moment. As I told you back in August, the importance of Remo Froehler, for example, is incredibly underrated, in my opinion. He is with Duran. A fantastic like two-man midfield. They have an incredible working rate and they are pivotal. Now, there were like some doubts, if you remember, when Frankie C left Atalanta for Milan, because he was really a working horse, we may say. Unbelievably, maybe after him and Gagliardini left the team, then Atalanta just improved. Because of the combination between Froehler and Duran. The team is completely different, but this means we should probably reconsider even how it starts football with that. Because if a team has no regista, as we call it in Italy, and it's not easy to translate, it doesn't mean, well, that team can't play offensive and maybe creative football, because Froehler is not a regista, Duran is not a regista. They're both like hard-working midfielders, but the game maybe is changing. Football is changing fast, and this also applies to the right-backs and left-backs like Castagne, Gosens, and Atebur, because all of them have been excellent and they're very important. Maybe not like the two midfielders, but the tactical asset gives them space to attack the flanks in depth, and I see a clear similarity with Atalanta when there was Andrea Conti as right back, because it was also a right wing. He made like two roles at the same time. And so this may mean we should redefine the game's roles, in my opinion, with Gasperini especially. I've seen so many players doing like multiple roles at the same time. And that's honestly really stimulating to analyze tactically.
Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about the back line. You know, they are, like you mentioned, a real three center back. So they don't, the wing backs really push more forward, so they have to be really solid. Now, I'd say the whole unit is probably really underrated. Toloi, Palomino, but the one that's getting, you know, a lot of attention is Mancini, because A, he scores a lot of goals and he's been linked to top clubs. So in a lot of ways, he's kind of following the Caldara trajectory. So if you had to compare Mancini to what we saw from Caldara last season at Atalanta, how would you rate him?
Well, like the other players I mentioned before, Gianluca Mancini even improved the game of his predecessor, we can say. Caldara was kind of excellent, but Mancini is his perfect sub. He has quite similar skills, even though Caldara is probably a better regista, we can say. But he impressed everyone, even scoring goals out of corner kicks and set pieces. However, we should not forget Mancini was playing instead of Caldara already at the end of last season. So it doesn't come as a surprise. He has always been a great defender in the youth setup. If everyone was watching the Primavera and the youth teams, he was a real product of the academy and everyone was expecting him, so he's not surprised. And I can add maybe a new name The next center back might be Davide Bettella. He's born in 2000 and now he's on loan to Pescara. He will surely come back at the end of the season, and I expect quite a lot from him. So this is like strange to say, but we always see a new sub to these players that are doing quite well, and it's stimulating to see this because Caldara, then Mancini, and now Bettella, maybe in the future. So there's always a new one, and all these players have similar characteristics, but it's quite interesting to see how Gasperini does well in making them improve.
Yeah, so I love that you're teasing us with one more, and I forget his name, but there was also one they bought from Cittadella in the summer that plays for the Italy youth teams that tore his knee, so Atalanta, and I forget his name, but Atalanta's always ahead of the game with the center backs and the defense especially. So now let's talk about two veterans, and actually I forgot to ask you earlier, so let's get to the attack, and this is Duvan Zapata, who's been on absolute fire recently. Now, I've always been a big fan of Duvan Zapata because I always felt he's the type of striker that even if he doesn't score, he's helping his team win in a lot of ways, but he's been really unstoppable recently. So what's been different about him in the past few months, in your opinion?
Well, Duvan has said in an interview that he had some troubles at the beginning of the season in understanding Gasperini's teachings quite. He said working with Gasperini required more effort than with any previous coach he had, and he had quite some coaches, and he had to completely forget some of his usual offensive movements, which is not easy for a striker, actually, in order to learn how to play in Atalanta's fluid 3-4-3. And in the last 2 months, Duvan has also improved physically. It's like, I could say, a diesel engine. He has started quite slowly, but now he's in the right range and is getting better match after match. Anyway, well, jokes aside, the last 2 months have been outstanding in every single match he has played. Duvan has evolved his playing style and he was able to never give up, even though he had those troubles at the beginning of the season. So now he's having back all the effort he put into adapting to, I can say, Gasperini's idea. It's both a physical and tactical combination, and it's unique. I always wonder if he'll continue like this also after Atalanta and Gasperini, because many players struggled in finding the same form after leaving Atalanta and Gasp. And well, I can think about the words said by an Italian journalist, Federico Buffa, when he told something about Gasperini's work. Before every match, some players, especially can say the youngsters, they hit the weights from the gym, and that gives them a special physical strength for 90 minutes, 2 hours. They are quite young players also that do this job. Moreover, 100% committed to the team, and also physically powerful. And this makes them give them a lot of energy and can be an explanation why they overperform at Atalanta and then they struggle outside that context probably.
So let's talk about the other two veteran strikers on Atalanta, and this is Iličić and Papu Gomez. And Iličić, to me, on his day, is one of the most talented players in all of Serie A. Papu Gomez, obviously, is the most famous player on Atalanta. So if you had to guess from now until the end of the season, which of these two players is going to have a bigger impact for the team?
Well, as you said, for the continuity, I always rely on Papu Gomez if I had to put my money. Because we can say he wasn't performing perfectly last season because of the Europa League, Serie A, and the double commitment. But this season, he's much better. He is also another player that changed his game. If you think about Duvan Zapata, because Gomez was scoring a lot of goals with Andrea Petagna as a striker. Now he's more an assist man, playing like more on the flanks, helping the team defensively, and with some class moments he always has, bringing the ball up when you need, you know, to waste some time in parts of the match. He had to change his game from Petagna to Zapata. And the same has been done by Josip Iličić lately. Both need to adapt to Duvan's style, which is not easy because Duvan is incredibly dominating inside the box. And that's not what was happening with Petagna. Duvan attracts like all the crosses inside, and that may bring a huge impact for Papu's style He doesn't have to shoot every time like before. And, well, I don't know who's going to have a bigger impact, actually, because I was also expecting a lot from Rigoni, to be honest. And Rigoni left Bergamo, like, without playing so much, even though he started quite well. So, well, sometimes the Gasperini way doesn't work for everyone. Doesn't work maybe for the players that doesn't have this kind of work ethic, because even though Papu and Iličić are quite old players, because they are after their 30, and in Bergamo, in Atalanta, they are old players, but I don't think they eat the weights every time before every match, but they have a great intensity in their trainings, it looks like. So anyway, for the continuity, I would always choose Papu.
Okay, so I purposely tried to cover as many players on Atalanta because, you know, I mean, some of our listeners are hardcore Serie A fans and they know pretty much everyone. We wanted to give kind of a more of a taste on the squad overall. Is there any other player that we didn't mention so far, or maybe one that we mentioned that you want to highlight even more for the contributions he's made to the team this season?
Well, yeah, I'd say a couple of names. First of all, Berat Gjimsiti, an Albanian center back that impressed also against Juventus in Coppa Italia by putting some limits on Cristiano Ronaldo. Well, he's not the easiest of opponents, I can say. And I would also add another name. He's another defender, and he's the real Gasperini offensive defender, Rafael Toloi. He has the skills required by the coach. He's really the Gasperini man on the pitch. With Mancini, Masiello, Palomino, Gjimsiti, is forming a great back line. And that also goes back to the concept of free man, pure defense line that Gasperini wants. These are the men that make Atalanta what it is. And I am afraid that when Gasperini will leave, this will not happen again. But this is a joy to watch for everyone, not just for Atalanta fans.
Yeah, but carpe diem, you know, maybe Gasperini, you know, realizes this is a great situation for him there. But let me ask you, and we're recording this on Monday before Atalanta plays Cagliari. So the standings in Serie A are really, really interesting. Atalanta's definitely in the mix for Europa League spot. They're not that far off from a Champions League spot, too, and they've been red hot. So as it stands now, and again, we're recording this before the match against Cagliari, where do you expect them to finish in the standings at the end of the season?
Well, actually, I expected them to be in the Europa League, and that did not work at the beginning of the season, so I'm clearly bad at this prediction. Anyway, I have to do this game, and I cannot say I would be surprised, to be honest, with a Champions League qualification. That means the fourth spot is possible, in my opinion. There are a lot of opponents there, but Atalanta are playing better than everyone else, in my opinion. They have self-esteem and a belief that all of the other teams don't have. I just have a regret that whatever comes next, Champions League or Europa League, which is, in my opinion, certain anyway, an European qualification, Atalanta won't play in Bergamo. Because of the stadium's makeover, yeah, which will finally happen probably next summer. This will take a huge amount of time, and the risk is when Gasperini will leave, the team will fall back to the usual days of my youth, actually when I was going to the stadium with La Dea in Serie B. And I remember witnessing 2-2s against Cittadella and also other strange matches like defeat against Livorno, draw against a team from those local valleys there, Albino Leffe. Still, I can't get over the fact that the best match we witnessed was the draw against Borussia Dortmund, the wins against Olympique Lyon, Everton. They all happened in Reggio Emilia, 2 hours from my home, so far from Bergamo, so far from the real heart of Atalanta. Mm-hmm. And I cannot stop telling to myself that if the match was played at Atleti Azzurri d'Italia, the results against Borussia would have been different. Maybe this is not true because I don't have a proof of that, but the push from the fans is real. And I can recommend everyone to witness it as firsthand. Because since it looks like we are having our big derby against Brescia next season, so we'll have a great fun in the next years. And this is really, really another prediction I should make today.
So, Bruno, I can't thank you enough. I really enjoyed it. Not only did you give us a great deep dive on what's going on in Atalanta, you gave us some things to look at the future. You talked about the past, going to the stadium. You're a gem. I can't think of a better person on Atalanta. So I'll tell you what, you know, if they keep pushing for a Champions League spot, we'll definitely have you back one more time before the season ends. In the meantime, best of luck in Germany. Great that you're working on the Italian station, DAZN IT. So I wish you all the best and thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you all very much, Alex and David.